Hey, I'm just out here at the studio making mischief in the cosmos.
Oh, great. Is it a good time for you to talk?
Sure.
Okay, cool. What are you working on?
I've got an exhibit that opens in March, so I'm working on about four or five different pieces for that show. Keeping busy.
And where's that show going to be?
It's going to be at Finch Lane, which is up by the University of Utah.
Oh,
I'll be
okay.
showing with another artist, Jody Plant. We're both doing assemblages mostly made out of natural materials.
Oh, excellent. That sounds interesting. Is
But
that.
I was just cleaning a big target bear that used for archery. So we're thinking of using her in the exhibit. So that's exactly what I was doing when you called.
Well, good. I'm glad you're making some artwork. So, is that a collaborative thing that you're doing with the other artist, or is it just both of you are in the same exhibition?
It's collaborative in that we try to use the same material. Like I'll use the stone, and then she will, and it just works out differently, but we're using similar materials.
I
And then
see.
we critique each other's work as we go along. So it's collaborative in that sense.
Do you do a lot of collaborative work?
No, this is maybe my second time. So it's an interesting exercise.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it opens up different kinds of channels than normal. And so when you're chasing those rabbits down the hole, it leads you to some new places. So I haven't used natural material a lot in my work. So I'm kind of liking that, like hornets' nests and feathers and thorns, stuff like that.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's interesting. So actual biological materials, not even,
Right.
even that's interesting. Why are you using those type of materials? Is that something that's part of the concept of the piece or?
Right. We decided to theme it around earth, wind, fire, and water, the four classic elements. And so we're kind of playing off of those four different materials in our search for objects for art making.
Yeah, that's interesting.
For example, I was in there's an American Indian store on Redwood Road here in Salt Lake City. So I was in the store, and there were four big hornets' nests that this Native American fellow from Idaho had brought in. He had collected off the reservation, so I was able to acquire those. So we're using I have two and Jody has two. So that's the kind of collaboration.
Yeah, very interesting. So that's a type of, is that something that they sell a lot of at that store?
Well, I've been there for going in for several years. It's the first time I've seen them there. So if they've had them there before, I was not aware, but it was perfect timing for our exhibit coming up. And that's kind of the nature of found objects. They tend to find you instead of you finding them.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen any kind of a insect nest for sale, personally.
Right, yeah. And they're beautiful. They're
Yeah.
two are large and two are a little smaller.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so can you tell me about how you got involved with the kit show at the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art?
I've had a relationship with the museum for several years. I've curated four different exhibits there myself, and I had a show of my work there once. And out of that exhibit, the museum purchased a piece titled Vindora. And Vindora is the object that they've used in their publicity.
Yeah, definitely. What shows did you curate there?
Do I again?
Oh, sorry about that. Sorry I interrupted you. I wanted to you go ahead and you can elaborate on what you were going to say, but I was going to ask you about the shows that you curated in the past at the museum.
Okay. Well, Vindora is, and I think it's probably a vending machine from Mexico, but I'm not sure. I'm not seeing another like it. But you have a face of could be like a fortune teller or a mystic. And then, of course, there are four different types of candies or objects that you put in your quarter, and you're able to get those out in the normal vending sense. But in those areas, I place different religious objects. And so the concept of a vending machine juxtaposed against people's value systems represented by the different objects is what I was kind of playing with on a conceptual basis.
Yeah. How much, when you do conceptual work like that, that has messages, how much information do you like to include through didactic paneling and text? And, you know, of course, you're not there in the museum to be able to explain it to people like you are to me. Do you have any feelings about that and about how much people have to interpret for themselves versus how much you're providing for them?
Yeah, it's always a good question. My work, typically, I don't provide a lot of background or contextualization. And that way it helps the viewer to build their own concept around the work itself. So they become the interpreter. Because once I put my interpretation out there, then it bends the viewer's ability to come up with their own take on it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So this occasion, you know, like a piece will be in a museum or some sort of an exhibit where everybody else is providing that didactic label. And so I acquiesce usually, but typically not.
Do you find gallery spaces and museums to be the ideal site for your artwork to be shown, or do you show elsewhere, like in public spaces or something like this?
Okay. My work, I've tried commercial galleries in the past, but the kind of work I do is more of a curiosity, I think, than people want to collect, at least in this part of the country. I think my work would probably go over pretty well in either the coast, east or west, or perhaps in Chicago, but there's not a lot of collectors here. And so what I do is show in not-for-profit spaces where there's not an expectation by a gallerist to earn money off of it in order to continue their operation.
Right.
So, yeah. I sell work, and some years it breaks even and some not. But I typically don't, market it as objects for sale, but more as objects for meditation and curiosity.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So have you ever thought about trying your hand at going to one of those big art markets and trying to immerse in that, you know, commodification of the work type of thing, or would you rather keep your hands off of that?
I think if there was a gallery that liked what I do and kind of gets it, and they have a clientele with the same disposition, I wouldn't have any trouble with it. But to be able to find those galleries, you almost have to like live in Los Angeles or New York. And I happen to be living in Salt Lake City, and this is where my family is. And Los Angeles and New York don't have the Southern Utah deserts. So that's why I like to hang around here in the Rocky Mountains.
What is it that you like about Utah the most? You know, what is it that you like about the desert and the mountains?
Sure. Well, I'm originally from Texas. In the fourth grade, we moved from north by Oklahoma, from Wichita Falls, down to Houston. And so happens that my parents landed in Houston's art district in the Montrose area. So I grew up with galleries and museums and bookstores and secondhand shops. And so that was pretty much an imprint on me in my early life. And once I came out here, though, and discovered hiking and backpacking and walking around in southern Utah, where the land is so rich with energy, if you will. I love going back. We go to New York about every year, and I go to Houston to see the family. But I don't have a yearning to live in the big city. And Salt Lake is just about right in terms of having an arts community. And it's 3.5 hour drive from here to Capitol Reef National Park, for example. So 3.5 hours, you can kind of get across Houston in that part of the country. So
yeah,
it's a more comfortable way of living for me.
It seems to me that living in Utah lends itself to the way that you want to actually make and produce the art and the inspiration that Utah provides to you, and that's more important to you than being in a place where you might be able to better sell the work. Is that a fair characterization?
I think so. There's a lot of tension. For example, you've got this overlay of a strong Mormon culture against people who are not so sympathetic. And so there's a lot of tension between those two poles. And I'm not saying there's not a lot of common ground in between, but the polarity creates an energy. And I think it's in that spectrum that my work kind of likes to inhabit. And so if I were in Houston, there wouldn't be so much of that, for example. There are other tensions and other ways of art making, but I happen to live here, and that's the kind of stuff that animates my work.
In what way do you have any specific examples of how that type of tension and that polarity has affected your work or been illustrated in it?
Yeah. Well, during most of my career, I've used discarded religious objects in my assemblage making. And so there's a lot of Mormon temples around, for example, but very few Buddhist stupas. And so I'm having to improvise. And so I've used the beehive shape to also as a stand-in for the Buddhist stupa. So one piece I have is a Buddha inside of a beehive, but the Buddha has bee wings. And so there's these juxtapositions that play out in my work. And I think Buddhists are pretty used to having their material objects utilized in artistic assemblage fashion and other ways, but not so much with the LDS community. And it's so young that there really isn't a tradition of symbolic material that's out there. They've adopted some of the Protestant Christian type of material, but in terms of making it its own, I think it's kind of in an infancy. So if you go into Deseret Book, it's not quite so interesting as going in to the Hare Krishna gift shop, for example. And so in terms of the political aspect of it, most of my work has a political subtext to it, whether it's dealing with environment or social issues. And that hopefully transcends any kind of religious tension in a community, because those are issues that I believe that we pretty much all need to be paying attention to.
Yeah. Do you find that since Utah is such a unique place politically and in terms of the culture and the religion mostly surrounding the church, that your work then has kind of a specific connection to people from Utah that maybe people from other states in the United States don't associate as, in the same way?
Yeah, I would think so, because like I said, Utah produces some of the material objects dealing with Mormonism that other places may not even be aware of. And so when I incorporate, for example, a model of the Salt Lake Temple in a big bird cage and put wings on it. The people here get that, but if you were to put it maybe out in Kansas somewhere, they probably wouldn't get the connotations.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, that's another good reason for you to be in Utah, I think.
Well, this is, you know, I've been here for so long, it's been over 40 years. And so I've become pretty well acquainted with the material culture that's here. Plus, you know, in my travels, I'm always collecting material wherever I go. So it's not like I'm totally dependent on Utah for providing stuff for my cults pile, if you will.
Yeah. So what are the biggest changes that you've seen in Utah if you've been here for 40 years? That's very interesting to me, because I don't know that many people who have been here for anywhere near as long as you have, who are, you know, came from somewhere else at least. So you actually come in kind of with a more objective eye, and you're able to see, you know, oh, okay, this is what makes Utah unique compared to other places that I've been. How have you seen it evolve?
Right. Well, I think in terms of the arts community, and I guess that's maybe where you're leaning in your question, the gallery scene is not that much different. There's been a lot of startup galleries that just unfortunately don't make it. And so there's a lot of startups and failures. Even some of the old standby galleries that you could depend on have closed as the owner's interests wane or finances or age comes into play. And so in terms of a commercial outlet for contemporary work, I don't think it's really changed all of that much. There's more support. We've got the 15 Bytes, for example, which is an online arts magazine. And you've got the Deseret News, finally has an art critic, Scotty. But the Salt Lake Tribune does not, and neither does the Ogden paper up in Logan where you are. And so art criticism, which is something that's pretty important to have in an arts community, is almost non-existent. The published material tends towards feature writing rather than art criticism. And so there's not a way to see your work through those other eyes.
Yeah.
Institutionally, you've got since I've come here, the museum up at the University of Utah, Brigham Young University, has a fine museum. And so Nora Eccles, University of Utah, and Brigham Young University makes for a really rich corridor in terms of museum going and curatorial work. And so that's kind of a change, if you will, that's pretty powerful in an arts community.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you interpreted my question as being related to the arts. I actually was just wondering in general, because it's hard to really separate. I think, you know, of course, the culture impacts the art scene, and the
right.
art scene impacts the culture. That's very interesting to me, though. And of course, your work deals with both.
Right. And there, you know, little cliques of people, you know, that gather in the coffee shops or gelato bars and breakfast meetings. And so you've got little groups around. And I think that's encouraging, where people have found support for themselves as well as their work.
Yeah.
And so that's, to me, is one of the most important aspects of having a strong community, is having artists supporting each other, and then having the institutions actually supporting the artists rather than focusing on the institution. They focus on the art making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
interesting. I think the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art downtown has undergone pretty drastic changes since I've been here. I've seen several different directors come and go, and I think they've got a pretty good combination now of incorporating local artists and their work with material that comes in from the national stage as well. And I think that's good for the community here to see that other work that comes through.
Yeah, that seems to be that museum's a big part of what they're trying to do is showcase local talent as well as show the local talent, the international and national talent. I completely understand what you're talking about because they have that one space that's devoted to Utah artists only.
Right, and that was you first come in. And then also downstairs there's another gallery that typically is inhabited by the works of a Utah artist through their Artist in Residence program.
Yeah, right.
And then quite often in the main show, they will incorporate some of the local artists with works by national characters as well. And this is all dealing with contemporary art. Then there's also Western art and more conservative work out there. And some of those artists are the ones that pretty much are able to make a living with their work, if you will. And so the conservative market stretches from Salt Lake up into Park City. So in terms of collectors, you've got to have collectors as well. And the contemporary collector market is still very young.
Right. Where does your work fall into those categories?
Well, I wouldn't call it traditional. It's not landscape or cowboys, and it's not abstract. And so it's assemblage is where I work mostly, and that is something that's really come to play as a way of making art just pretty much in the early to mid-20th century. And in terms of assemblage in Utah, there's a few of us out here that do that kind of work, but not a lot. And I don't know of others that incorporate as much discarded religious material as I tend to do. So that makes it a little bit unique from other artists' assemblage work.
Yeah. Are you influenced by some of those big-name assemblage people from art history? For the aesthetic, or?
Yes, I remember being at this party. And I was at the time I was making boxes and objects in boxes, and this fellow turned to me and says, "Well, this is kind of like a Joseph Cornell would do," and I didn't know who that was. And so I started investigating and discovered that there's a family out there. Joseph Cornell, for example, Louise Nevelson does fabulous found object work. And then later on, I discovered the Keenholtz's, Nancy and Ed Keenholz's work. And so, yes, and I would say the Keenholz's have had a big influence on me, more so than perhaps some of the others.
Yeah, interesting. I want to ask you specifically about the Kitsch exhibition at Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art. What is your definition of kitsch, and how do you feel about the word and being described as kitsch?
Well, I think we've all been visitors to relatives and friends' houses, and they will just have a lot of mementos and collected objects from their travels. And it's more sentimental than artistic. And so kitsch, to me, falls into that more sentimental range. And it's mass-produced. And mass production, of course, is one of the foundations of assemblage work. It started in about 1915 or so by Marcel Duchamp and with his ready-mades. And then moved from the ready-mades, especially after World War II, there's a ton of mass production of material. And so it became this great kitschy kulch pile from which assemblage artists were able to draw. And so kitsch to me maybe has a different connotation than it would to, say, like a high sophisticated, well-educated person who is only interested in fine European work, for example. To me, it's low stuff, and that's kind of where I pull my material from, kind of as a bottom feeder, if you will. So in terms of how that plays out at the Nora Eccles Museum, they've got, and I counted there about at least 30 different objects that were religious in nature, and most of those were from Mormon collections from the LDS Historical Library in Salt Lake City. And so when you talk about going into Deseret Book, for example, and seeing the three-dimensional material, yes, I would put most, not all, but most of that into the kitsch category that's locally produced. And so I think the museum did a pretty good job of representing the local religious kitsch. I've got a friend, Jeffrey Valance, who has two pieces in the exhibit that are paintings, and he's made his reputation dealing with kitschy material as well as kitschy themes. He just recently had an exhibit at the Warhol Museum of his reliquaries, and inside of his reliquaries are kitschy little objects, but out of context and put into the framework of a retablo, it changes the nature of it. It gives it a sense of spirituality that it probably wouldn't have otherwise.
So do you think kitsch is a negative thing?
Mostly I think people, at least the artists that I know, dismiss kitsch and find it maybe amusing, but not necessarily something that they would go out and spend their resources to acquire. But but in terms of the mass culture in the area, I think it would be collected for sentimental reasons more than for aesthetic purposes.
Well, yeah. But I would say that's the reason that most people like artwork in the first place is more sentimental than aesthetic, actually.
Well, it's true, and I guess it's just a matter of scale and degrees. I don't think any of us buy something or purchase something that we don't have some sort of an affinity for, and perhaps that affinity can be looked at as being sentimental. Fundraising, for example, people tend to donate to causes where they have some sort of a sentimental attachment to the purpose of the organization that they're supporting. And maybe the intellect will come in to it at some point, but it's the sentiment that causes them to give of their time, their talent, or treasure in a philanthropic sense. And I think it's the same way with art collecting.
Yeah, probably. It just depends. Depends on the person.
Person and ability to acquire, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's excellent. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add? I mean, I think that was a really good little conversation there.
Good. Yeah, I would encourage people to go see Taste at the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum. I think it's a great institution, and the exhibit is exploring territory that doesn't get a lot of attention in this area. California, for example, has had many great exhibits dealing with assemblage, but not necessarily as keying in on kitsch as the subtext of it. And so I think that is an eye-opener for people to be able to narrow their focus in on kitsch material instead of the big, huge au revoir of assemblage stuff that's out there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
so kudos to Nora Eccles, I guess, and the curators. There's three curators involved with the show. It takes a lot of work to pull the show together and contextualize it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you are happy with the, you know, the exhibition that your show is, or that your artwork is in, and that your artwork is kind of the poster piece for the exhibition. So I'm glad that you like it.
It's amazing how whimsical work in the studio winds up in some places and then kind of gets its own notoriety separate from the artist even. So I'm glad Vendora has her own little fan club. Because she's a great, great funny lady.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's been a popular piece. I've had to. I work in the museum too, and I've had to remind a few people to keep their hands off of it because, you know, we don't want it to get broken. That was a funny part of your talk at the opening reception where you encouraged people to. Touch the piece and interact with the piece, and the director said, no, don't tell people to do that.
No. Well, yeah, I've always, my work, a lot of it is interactive, and so the piece is really meant to be interactive and people put in their quarter. And like with a lot of things that we look at as our values, we put money into it, but sometimes we don't get anything out of it. So you can put in your quarter, but you don't get an object back. So it's just kind of part of the pun of the piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so does it bother you that the museum isn't allowing that to be? I mean, cause that seems like that's a big part of the piece, the concept of the piece. Is the piece not really being fully experienced properly because it's we're telling people not to touch it?
Well, once an object leaves the studio and winds up in a museum, a whole different set of circumstances come into play, and criteria, preservation, on and on and on. So I can see the museum's point of view on it. But then it becomes like a stuffed animal instead of something that's alive.
Yeah.
And I don't have any control over that.
Yeah, I guess not. You know, it's funny you said, you know, the difference between a stuffed animal and an animal that's alive. Are you familiar with the author Boris Groys? He writes about art a lot.
No.
He argues that museums and galleries are where artwork goes to die. It's the cemetery of artwork.
Yeah, that's kind of the way it is. But without that, as a mechanism, there's a lot of great work that we all appreciate and enriches our lives that wouldn't exist. It's the devil if you will, devil if you don't.
Right.
So it's an old dance.
Yeah. Well, so is there a date for your upcoming exhibition, your collaborative one that you mentioned earlier that we could let people know about?
Oh, yes. The opening is the first Friday of March. I think that's what, the 4th or 5th? I don't have my calendar in front of me. And then the show runs for a month. And so I'd encourage anybody that's interested in assemblage work to come to the Finch Lane Gallery by the University of Utah and take a peek. That's great. And then I have another exhibit down in Snow College in September. So it's a huge installation dealing with 9/11. So those are the two things I've got coming up.
Oh, really? What's the? Can you tell me more about that piece?
In 2004, I was invited to show with another artist at the Utah Valley University, and I noticed that the exhibit date was in September. So I thought, well, why don't I explore a memorial making with the 9/11 event? And so I made a couple of pieces for that show. And then I started showing every year thereafter at different spaces and adding more and more pieces as I went along. And so it's grown into a full-blown installation. I've had it down at the in Houston at the Houston Baptist University. I had a little bit of the showing of it in Boise. So it's been around almost every year since 2004.
And is it always something that's deals with the close to the time, you know, the September? Is that always when you show it, the piece? Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it keys off of September 11th, but it actually underneath deals with terror in all of its manifestations, even historically.
Mm-hmm.
And so just as a way to keep us sensitive to the issues dealing with terror.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, I'm 29 years old, so I'm one of the last generations of people who actually remembers the United States pre 9/11 and pre perpetual wartime.
Right.
And I think that's really interesting. It's kind of an understated thing that people don't realize. I'm always pointing this out to people and to my students, and you know, they have absolutely no idea, no recollection of that. You know, of so-called peacetime, of pre-9/11 peacetime. And
right.
I think it's kind of, I think there's a lot to that, actually, that we kind of just, that we don't really acknowledge and consciously think about and realize what that really means, to how that affects the way we interact with each other and the way that we think about history and the future. So that's a very interesting subject matter.
Yeah, that's a triggering point in history that's catapulted our policy and our treasure into the Middle East in ways it's never been before. And I think in terms of having, quote, peace, is something that's just not going to happen. But we have to fight for it as much as we can, and it's in that struggle that our humanity stays alive.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully.
So,
fantastic.
This has been a great interview. I hope some of it is useful to you.